You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. I get to say that still. I'm sort of surprised. It's the middle of September.
Is well, it completely rainy? It is sunny. We're not seeing any rain. We have had a rapid temperature change here in the Sacramento Valley. We mentioned last week, weather whiplash, as meteorologist Daniel Swain likes to call it. Weather whiplash is when you go rapidly from extremely or unusually high temperatures to unusually low temperatures and back. And so it was in the upper 90s just a few days ago. And today's high, Lois and I are preparing this on September 11, 2024 for broadcast on September 12th. And today's high is going to be 85 degrees.
Wow.
Tonight is going to be 54 degrees and clear. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 86 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 54 degrees and clear. Friday, 89 degrees and sunny. Friday night, mostly clear, 55 degrees. Saturday, 86 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, mostly clear and 55 degrees. You notice a pattern here, but we're going to drop. Let me interject something here. 2 years ago at this week, we had just come out of record-shattering heat wave here in the Sacramento Valley. We had had a week where it was 116 the next day, 116 being our highest ever temperature, then 110 and 110, then 106 for 3 days in a row. That happened 2 years ago at this time of year. By comparison, on Sunday, it will be 77 degrees and mostly sunny. We'll take that, thank you. Sunday night, a chance of showers.
What?
Mm-hmm. Mainly after 11 p.m., mostly cloudy Sunday night with a low around 56 degrees. Monday, a chance of showers. This is new. This was not in the weather forecast 2 days ago. Partly sunny with a high near 76. Monday night, a slight chance of showers, partly cloudy with a low around 54. And Tuesday, a slight chance of showers, mostly sunny with a high near 78. So highs next week in the upper 70s. Compare that to a couple years ago when we were still recovering from an epic heat wave. People keep asking me how late can, you know, when can we plant? How is early is too early? How late do we get high temperatures?
Calendar doesn't work.
Right. It's, you know, in September, we officially go into fall by the calendar, but the latest date of 100 degree weather is just after the first week of October here in the area. It's something like October 7th or 8th that we have hit 100 degrees. It's not uncommon at all for us to be very warm in late September, early October. We also typically get, as we mentioned last week, a lot of north wind events as we go into this change of the seasons, which can be very dry. But we're definitely on a cooling trend. Almost every garden center, every hardware store is bringing in all those cool season vegetables, including, we all started with the brassicas, which are tougher plants, but even lettuces and kale and spinach and all that kind of stuff. People are getting a great start on it this year and getting them in early, compared to, let's say, 2 years ago. And you'll get great results if you can get some of those things in, keep them watered once a day, thorough watering for a young seedling you've just put out of a broccoli or a cabbage or something. That'll be really cool. You'll get a good early start on that, and you can keep planting those things, most of them, as we'll tell you, week to week, all the way into the winter, all the way through the winter in the case of some of them. So great planting weather right now. So the other question that came up was, well, what if it gets hot again? These are generally plants that once they're past that transplant stage will be tough enough, fine enough to go through any kind of weather that our climate here can dish out. It's not a problem to put them in and then suddenly have a spike in higher temperatures as long as you keep them watered. I mentioned the term transplant stage. My experience is that a plant will go through a shock, as we used to call it in the business, transplant shock, of 2 to 3 days. After you plant the seedling out, 2 to 3 days, you got to watch it pretty carefully, especially if it's unusually warm or unusually dry and windy. But really all that means is watering it correctly. A good thorough soaking once a day is likely to be necessary if we have normal to average temperatures here. I'm talking about new little plants of vegetables and flowers and things like that that you're putting in. 1 gallon, 5 gallon things, of course, you keep an eye on the watering as well. But we're at the beginning of major landscape planting, beginning of seed planting in turf and so forth. And of course, lots of people jumping right in now to plant those cool season vegetables, except for a problem. Your summer vegetables are still out there growing and producing. So we'll talk more about that. But the weather looks great. KDRT is community radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And you had a PSA.
I actually have two things for you this week. First is the 100-acre UC Davis Arboretum includes walking paths and picnic areas set amongst more than 20,000 trees and plants. The greenery is arranged in a series of gardens that represent different geographies or themes, including California natives, coast redwoods, oaks from around the world. For more information, visit arboretum.ucdavis.edu.
And that's 100 acres is the core arboretum. I believe now they officially call the entire UC Davis campus part of the arboretum. Arboretum folks have been planting fascinating plants out everywhere. You'll pull into a parking lot for a conference or something, and you'll look over, and there in the parking lot will be aloes and agaves and natives and all these cool flowering things.
And little signs on them. Mm-hmm. And amazing. The other thing I wanted to tell you about is, you know, we over the course of the year will continue to tell you about the African Violet Society meeting here, the rose thing, that all that other. If you want to know what is meeting at what used to be called the Shepherd Garden Center and is now the Sacramento Garden and Arts Center, you can go to their calendar, and it's at sgaac.org/calendar. So I looked up, why did they change the name? And I found a little article about history over there. It turns out it was the Sacramento Garden and Arts Center when it first started. And then it was renamed in honor of a local person named Shepherd. And then recently they've decided to go back to the historic name because, I don't know, they liked it. So Sacramento Garden and Arts Center, abbreviated SGAAC.
And I'm looking at it right now, and there are, I don't even know how many garden clubs that are highlighted here, and you can find all their events. And yes, the Gisneriad and African Violet Society. We've got the Ikebana International Iris Society. They all meet there. It's a great facility. So,
And this weekend is the African Violet Society. They have twice a year, they have an event.
Leave your wallet at home.
Saturday and Sunday, bring your credit card. it is easy to get hooked on that stuff because they're such beautiful things they have.
Well, the other thing, it's easy to propagate them. You don't have to spend a penny to have a great collection of African violets because you can take a leaf. If you've got some friend that has one that you like, you can break off a leaf and root it. You can root it in water and watch through the roots and the new plant form. It's one of the simplest plants to propagate. That's one of the reasons they've been so popular over the years is that anybody can start an African violet without paying a penny. All you need is a mason jar and some saran wrap and poke a hole in it and stick the leaf into the water held up by the saran wrap. I hope this makes sense. And watch it root, a great project for kids. And then when they root and start to grow, you pot them up in special soil. And that's where you might want to go to, I don't know, an African Violet Society meeting and find out what kind of soil is best.
When he says the mason jar with poke the hole in that thing, okay, that works. It works. I use little short shot glasses because they're smaller. But when you decide that it's grown enough, you're going to plant it. Don't pull the thing out. You got to cut the plastic. The first time I tried that, I pulled it out and everything just scraped off, and
they
I was
all the root. rooting things in water is actually fun, but the roots that form are poorly attached. And so, well, it can be a great project. Let's say you have a coleus plant that you really like, and you want to keep it through the winter, but you don't feel like digging it up. It's out in the garden. You can take a cutting. They root extremely easily, and you can root it in water. And I've actually known people who just stick them in water and let them grow roots in the jar all through the winter. The plant growing like a house plant, and then they take it back outside when we're past any danger of frost. But when you root in water, as Lois alludes, you have to handle them very carefully. So if you're really into propagation, you should get perlite and vermiculite, mix them 50-50 or something like that, and root into that, because those roots will be transplanting better into your garden or your potting soil, your garden soil. But it's fun. You can watch things root easily, and some things root just astoundingly easily. We've got lots of people coming through our garden center right now buying houseplants for the first time. School year is starting up here at UC Davis, and many of them are surprised to learn that pothos that they're buying, you can just take a piece and stick it in water and watch the roots grow. It's sort of like, this is how we hook you. Become long-term houseplant customers. We're telling you how to get them free, but we also know that once you're hooked, you'll be back. Okay. There's
lots of. Now, before we go out off of that, I want to do one more thing. African violets, rooting African violets. So, you know, you don't have to do all of that fancy stuff. All you have to do is take that leaf that you cut and cut it long. Cut it so it's fairly long. And then get some of the potting soil like you use for African violets and put a little of that rooting hormone, that thing. Nope, yep, and you don't need to have that. But if you do, it makes it go faster. Poke your finger in about a quarter of an inch. Lay the root in there. Cover it up. The new plant is going to grow from the broken end of the stem. Mm-hmm. That's where it grows from. It doesn't grow further up. So you don't want to try and poke that thing in there an inch down and straight up. You want to put it at an angle and it's barely covered by the dirt. Now, all of that sounds really complicated when you say it, but gee, if I could just show it to you. Cut a leaf, poke a hole, lay the leaf down, cover it up, you're done. And just keep watered.
Here's the cool thing. I don't know how we got onto this. Here's the cool thing about African violets and their cousins, Gisneriades, members of Gisneriaceae. Once you get the hang of rooting leaves of African violets, out of that show, you might see Streptocarpus or certain other members of Gisneriaceae. That's a plant where you can take a whole leaf, flatten it on a flat of rooting medium, make slits in the veins on the leaf, hold them down somehow, and they will root and grow at every place you make a slit. You can get 20 or 30 new Streptocarpus out of a single leaf of an existing Streptocarpus, which is a very cool Gisneriade. So you go out there, you get a leaf from someone, you buy an African violet, you find your comfort level with it, and then you go back to the show next year and you start buying some of the other fascinating members of Gisneriaceae.
So okay. Don, is that Gisneriade with the 20 little plants growing out of it, is that like your sunflowers that make a big bouquet? powdered together.
If you tried to grow them all together, yes, that would be a little complicated. So somewhere in that process, you separate them from each other.
You cut the leaf up.
Yeah, separate the little plants. People who are into propagation develop a whole set of special tools for that process.
So. Oh, yeah.
All right, there's lots of great programming here at KDRT, lots of new shows. And in this year alone, we've had several new programmers come in, which is wonderful. I want to bring one to your attention. The Yolo County Breakdown with Rocky Outcrop is his name. Bluegrass, New Grass, and Beyond. From Bill Monroe to Billy Strings, Yolo County Breakdown is a journey through acoustic string music, ranging from the traditional to the cutting edge. Rocky Outcrop has a quote here, as Duke Ellington wrote, ooh, you got me right there. As Duke Ellington wrote, there are simply two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. Rocky likes the good kind. So that is Fridays, 10 to 11 a.m. Replays a couple times during the week. So for rebroadcast time for all the programming here at KDRT, just click on the schedule guide.
Okay, I'm so glad that you described that show, because when I first saw the title, I thought it was to be, someone from the county telling us what's happening.
What's breaking down?
The breakdown of the, music, man.
No, the recent show, he comments here, you can't spell bluegrass without the blues. So he was feeling the blues and spun a bluesy set of bluegrass for your enjoyment. Etta Baker, Lucinda Williams, and others. Music shows only hang out for 2 weeks in the archives. So if you want to hear that one, head on over quickly. September 6th program. Lots of great programming here at KDRT.
Or subscribe and get them on a podcast, and then it's on your computer and you're safe.
Yep.
Don, I want to talk to you about September. We are now into September. This is our second show in September. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to do the pictures with the flowers this week. We'll do that next time. But I do want to talk about some of the opportunities, the gardening opportunities that you have. It says, shop now for perennials, spring blooming flower bulbs, and landscape plants. That means it's a good time to plant things. Mm-hmm. And then shrubs. Prune evergreen shrubs when the heat breaks. Well, I think the heat is broken.
We hope so, and it's probably broken enough. This is pruning things like, your hedges, your evergreen shrubs, plants like star jasmine. You know, if you prune those and it's really hot, we used to have a landscape crew, and I remember this vividly because the customer had us prune back her star jasmine, and then we had a heat wave the next week, and all the exposed new, you know, leaves that had been shaded and were now exposed burned. They scorched. It was terrible. It looked awful for months. So we generally hold off a major pruning during extreme heat or even what you might call normal heat around here. So, you know, late September through October is great. March, April is the other time to do most of those kinds of plants. Just not a great idea to be pruning when it's really, really hot out there.
It is also a great time to prune your fruit trees. If they're done fruiting, and you can go and trim them back as you wish.
Yeah. Yeah, summer pruning of fruit trees, September is still time to do that. The two that matter the most for this, and we want to just say this over and over because this information hasn't really gotten into extension publications or standard recommendations everywhere. It's getting there. Do not prune apricots or cherries in the winter when it's raining. Okay, those two in particular. Apricots get you type of disease. Cherries get Botrytis firea disease, infecting through pruning wounds. If it rains within a couple weeks of your having made those pruning wounds. If they've had a chance to scar over for, let's say, 4 to 6 weeks, appears to be what I find in the literature, then you should be safe. We're not likely to really rain here. You know, yeah, we started the show with chance of rain Monday. That's not what I'm worried about. We're not likely to really rain here until about the 1st of November. And of course, our main rainfall season is November through February. So those two in particular, you don't want to be pruning in the winter. And I know, you know, all the textbooks and all the old extension publications had you doing your pruning on them, as with other fruit trees, deciduous fruit trees, when they're dormant. Anywhere you're listening in California, you should probably not prune apricots and cherries. You might check with your local extension advisors and see whether that's relevant in other parts of the country. But it's also a great time to prune plums, peaches, all those other things for size control. Most people do their structural pruning in the winter, except for apricots and cherries, and they do their size control pruning increasingly in late summer. And it's easier. It's not muddy out there. It's not blazing hot right now either. You can just get out there, get up on a short ladder and shorten things up. That's pretty much what you're doing in the case of all the others. But on your apricots and cherries, the main pruning you do is late August through September.
Now, if we're talking about perennials rather than trees, the comment is plant seedlings of foxgloves, candy tuft, columbine, coral bells, pinks, and many more.
Yeah, there is loads of perennials and biennials. Quick, Lois, what's a biennial?
Something that takes 2 years to go through its life cycle.
Yeah, grows the first year, blooms the second year, and then typically seeds and dies, where, you know, many of them are, you know, foxglove was the first one you mentioned. That's why I actually asked the question. Foxglove is actually usually sold as a biennial. You plant it in the fall, it blooms the next spring and summer, goes to seed, and then that plant you planted dies. If you let it go to seed, you'll have foxgloves forever. most of the others, what I mentioned, candy tuft, columbine, those are all perennials. It's a great time to plant all of those things, but it's actually a particularly good time to start planting biennials for bloom next year. This is a category of plants nurseries wish you all would get to know better because they give so much bloom for what you're planting, but you have to be thinking 6 to 9 months ahead. So it's a challenge for retailing. It's a challenge. But these are some of the really old favorite garden plants, you know, foxgloves, delphiniums, hollyhocks, things that are very familiar are almost all either biennials or short-lived perennials. And of course, permanent perennials can also go in the fall.
But if I don't want to wait for a year for everything to happen. Hey, yeah. I'll just plant annuals. And this is a good time to plant annuals too. You can start them from seeds or you can buy the plants. And the list here is pansies, violas, snapdragons, calendula, stocks, sweet alyssum, and more.
Yep.
And it says broadcast wildflower seeds. And then we're going to have to talk about that one. But let's finish this part first.
Yeah. And some of the things that I mentioned, like foxgloves, because the horticulture industry understands that you don't want to wait that long, there are versions that have always come on the market that bloom faster. So there is a foxglove that blooms the same year you plant it. But yeah, all those others you mentioned are beginning to come into nurseries, pansies, violas, snapdragons. Yes, you can do them from seed yourself if you're inclined to that. But most of these are really so simple to just buy a six pack and put them in the ground. You get a lot of bang for your buck out of that. Calendulas reseed all over the place. That's one of those plants you only really have to plant once. Sweet alyssum, same category. This is the time to plant stock. If you're a fan of the fragrant old-fashioned stock, this is the time to get it in. You plant. I try to say this every year because people come in looking for it in October and November. If you buy a plant of stock, which is a lovely sweet-smelling annual that's very familiar, if you buy it later in the season, that little seedling will just make one spike of flowers. If you plant it now, it'll branch from the base and make several spikes of flowers. So let's just say you get more for your money planting earlier in that particular case.
Okay. And that's the fun flower stuff. What about the stuff we eat? What about the vegetables?
Yeah, that's a long topic that we'll probably do in more detail. But right now, broccoli, cauliflower, seeds of carrots, seeds of beets, things like that. Lettuce, greens, leafy greens. We're talking about bok choy, spinach, things, and kale, of course. Peas, you can plant from seed right now. And I mentioned onions, if you're doing them from seed, if you happen to like to grow your own onions from seed. Most nurseries like ours bring in bare root onions in November, and that's way easier. So, you know, it's on the list for September if you're going to do seed, but you know what? For a few pennies a piece, you can buy the plants a couple months from now and you'll get better results. So you can do it either way.
So that brings us to another question. The summer flowers are still blooming.
Yep.
Do we rip them out to put in the winter flowers?
That's, you know, this is a personal preference. If you watch the way they manage commercial landscapes, let's say the shopping center in South Davis, you know, where they do annual beds, are maintained with things in bloom all the time. They come in there, I've watched this, five times a year, pull out the things that are just past their peak of bloom. You're looking at them and going, wait, why are you taking those out? They're still blooming. And then you realize, yes, but they're beginning to fade. Mm-hmm. So they do it for a commercial landscape, or if you're working in public gardens or things like that, this is what you do. As soon as they're past their peak, you start pulling those out and putting in new plants, so they'll be blooming 2 months down the road. Personally, I don't mind watching things finish bloom, go to seed. In some cases, I want them to go to seed. In other cases, I don't. So I use a case-by-case evaluation, but with the usual weather we get here in September and into October, your summer flowers, and we're talking about things like zinnias and even marigolds and such, should continue blooming at least till the middle or late part of October. So your choice, this is a good time to start planting things for cool season bloom. Maybe pull out the worst of them or the ones that are past their prime and leave some of the nicer ones and interplant. That does work. But generally speaking, to keep a nice bed of annual color, not that many people doing that anymore, but it, you know, it was a really standard thing in commercial landscapes for a long time. You do five or six times a year, change things out, either all at once if you've got a landscape crew doing it, or for most home gardeners, it's a matter of looking at the ones that are peaking, cutting some of them back, making space for the new seedlings, hand watering those new seedlings because they need a little special attention, and then they'll be there ready to go as the others of your summer flowers, I should say, are beginning to peak out.
So now I want to talk to you about what to plant in September. And we did a little bit of all this already, but Don has written a very long document about what to plant now. We had that really hot July. It's over. We haven't had a heat wave recently, and that's good. The tomatoes, well, maybe they're done or maybe they're still going. It depended on how your tomatoes
were handled. That.
Yeah. But there's all these things that are standard September things. So how much of this do you want to go through, Don, or do you want to just tell them where the document is?
This is at redwoodbarn.com, but the things that we plant in September are the brassicas, is the term we use for everything that's related to broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, Romanesco, collards, kohlrabi, and then things like mustard greens and bok choy. There are legumes, meaning peas in particular, snow peas. Snap peas are wildly popular. That's the most popular type of pea that anybody likes to plant. Snap peas are the ones where you can just pick it off the plant and eat it, which is what most of us do. You don't have to string them. You don't have to shell them. Just eat them right off the plant. And fava beans start going in September. Leafy greens, most of us held off on those while it was still in the 90s because they don't hold up in nurseries that well, but the plants are okay. We brought them in and just moved them over to light shade. And that's anything from lettuce to radicchio to spinach to corn salad, endive, all that kind of thing. And of course, Swiss chard, which you can plant any time of year. You can start planting root vegetables, carrots, radishes, turnips, all go in now. Be sure you'll be able to water them daily because that seed that you're planting, so you got to keep a close watch on it. Seedling stage is vulnerable to drying out. Put it where you'll have a water can nearby or a hose that makes it easy to give a good soaking each morning. Garlic comes into nurseries in September and it can be planted all the way through October and November. Shallots, maybe September, depends on the vendor. And of course, as I mentioned at the start of the show, we plant onions in November here in the Sacramento Valley. Wherever you're listening, there's probably a good or best time for planting onions. I will tell you, we are in a place where you can plant them November through February and still get good results. And we can plant any kind of onion here because we're in an intermediate zone with respect to day length. So you can get a little overwhelmed trying to learn about onions and which ones to plant where. If you're in the Sacramento Valley, we're gold. We can plant pretty much any of them. I'll tell you a quick story. My kid came into possession of 200 Walla Walla onion starts in February. One of his coworkers had a bunch of them, had ordered them, forgot had ordered them, and had no way to plant them. So it was kind of muddy. So handed them to my child, who brought them home and said, "What do I do with these?" I said, "Well, it's February. We'll see how it goes, because we normally plant those in November." Dug the beds. He elevated them. So they're mounded up. This is really important in the winter. So the water would drain away. I provided some nitrogen because that's beneficial. Planted the 200 starts and he soaked them in real thoroughly. And from that point until the rain stopped, he didn't really have to do much of anything except monitor for the weeds. Harvested about 150 Walla Walla onions in July. So here, will we sell you Walla Wallas in November? Planting them in February worked just fine. Planting in January works fine. So it's not a panic if the nursery runs out of onions in November. You can still order them. You can still get them and plant them as late as January or even apparently mid-February and get very, very good results. It was a very affirming, wonderful project to be able to just grow some onions and then suddenly have so many, they're giving them away to their friends. And they were beautiful. They were 5 inches in diameter, giant Walla Walla onions. Planted in February, harvested in July. Had you planted in November, you could probably have harvested in June and still used, you know, that space for some peppers or even some late tomatoes or something like that. But it worked great. So we're in a place where onions are insanely easy to grow. It's also a good time to plant all those flowers we talked about at the beginning of the program. So those are all good things to go in right now. And it's also the beginning of seeding season. Scattering seed on your turf, scattering cover crop seeds, scattering wildflower seeds. Personally, I prefer to wait till we're closer to an actual rainstorm so I don't have to set a sprinkler and do all that kind of stuff. But you can start now. I can tell you that because where I have watered on my farm, grassy weeds are coming up. So that's my indication. It's a good time to scatter some of those things. Nature is showing me the way.
So that was very little bit of this huge, long document. Is this a document that is available for people to go and read?
Yeah, at redwoodbarn.com, you have a couple things. One is the link to this Davis Enterprise article, which is about what to plant in September. You also will find big charts on fall planting and what you plant and when you'd be harvesting. And the Master Gardeners have one that we helped them with a couple of years ago. So you'll find that at their website and sometimes at their informational tables. Because the fall planting season is not as familiar to people as the when and how we plant the summer vegetable garden. There's a lot of things we can grow here. We have a full-on second vegetable gardening and flower gardening season here all over California, actually, at least at the lowland parts of California. We get cold enough in the winter that the things that like chilling benefit from it, the kale and things like that, where the flavor is improved, but we don't get cold enough to injure them. So it's really a wonderful gardening climate for food stuff. And particularly what I like to mention to people who are maybe novice gardeners is that the winter garden is so much easier. The only thing you really have to battle is weeds, honestly. Figure out what you're going to do about that, because a lot of them will come up with the rains and you'll have to hand pull them or mulch them with straw or something. Other than that, you know, you get some fertilizers in there when you plant them, and you plant them in the right spacing, and you monitor for a few bugs like aphids and caterpillars that might get on them. Beyond that, you don't have to water. You know, once the rains begin, then and the days are shorter and it's cooling off. So it's a much easier thing to grow the winter garden than the summer garden in many respects. But do plan for the weeds, because that can they can come up and just choke everything out. Mulching can make a huge difference for that.
All right. Well, let's go on to daffodils and narcissus. Which ones should I plant? That's the question of this article. And it says, if you want familiar big flowered ones, plant trumpet daffodils. They'll yes. repeat year after year, but usually don't increase. If you like novelty flowers, try the split cup and double forms. Don's experience is they don't return well in future years.
Return well, meaning come back and bloom year after year. So a couple years is more typical for the split cup and double forms of daffodils.
If you want big showy flowers on plants that multiply, plant large cup and small cup types and the dwarf trumpets.
Let's stop with that one right there. February gold is a daffodil. It's a miniature daffodil that multiplies very, very freely, at least in our area, and I believe it does in other areas. It only blooms about 12 to 14 inches tall, and it has a perfect little trumpet flower. Trumpet daffodils are what most people are thinking of when they ask me for a daffodil. And my 6 to 12 bulbs that I planted 30 years ago, I now get about 60 or 70 blooms in that area. And they've also receded a bit nearby, which surprised me a little bit. So this one does what we in the business call naturalizes freely. It does come back and it looks like a little miniature King Alfred daffodil. It's just a shorter stature plant that has some advantages. In wet years, big, heavy flower daffodils on tall stems, if we get a driving rainstorm, they're face down in the mud. So these shorter ones hold up better.
If you want super fragrant flowers on plants that will multiply even more freely, plant from among the other divisions.
I'll read these off. Cycloninias, which are a dwarf type of daffodil with a sweet, pleasant fragrance. Tazetta, which includes the well-known paper white narcissus, are pungent and musky smelling. So some people like them, some people don't. Triandrus daffodils or narcissus really are shorter blooming with more sweet flowers.
For elegant flowers, try the tall, late blooming Poeticus narcissus. Poeticus? Yeah.
Poeticus is there's all these classes of daffodils which are based on the flower form. The Poeticus have a tiny eye in the center and great big petals. They're very lovely plants and they have a light, sweet scent. Fragrance of daffodils is a little controversial. Fragrance of narcissus, I should say. All daffodils are narcissus. The term daffodil is usually used to refer to the large flowered, especially trumpet shaped ones. Narcissus is all of them, but when someone comes in and says they're looking for narcissus, either they're English, in which case they refer to all of them that way, or they are referring to the smaller flowered, more fragrant types. And some of those are really great garden plants. They tend to really multiply very freely, but not everybody likes the scent. Lois is not a fan of paper white narcissus, for example. And I know lots of people who don't like the fragrance. So that's something to ask about. Even within that category, there are three strains of paper white narcissus on the market. One of them is powerfully fragrant. One of them is barely fragrant. And one's kind of intermediate. So there are strongly scented ones and lightly scented ones. Personally, I would not bring a paper white narcissus into the house. I like them out in the garden, but it's a pretty overpowering fragrance. But a lot of them have a nice sweet scent that's pleasant, but not overbearing.
You said there are three paper white narcissus with different fragrances. Do they look the same?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, then, Don, why don't you just always sell the ones that aren't going to make people sneeze?
Because many people love the fragrance.
Some people sneeze and some people go, oh, yeah.
Something for everybody. Yes, sir.
Okay. The last paragraph says, for cute little plants that multiply exuberantly, nearly all extra fragrant, plant some of the species types and tell us about those.
Narcissus canaliculatus. It's just sold under that name. It's not even a cultivar. Gets 6 inches tall. Cute little plant for containers. You're seeing some of these actually in grocery stores in the spring. Some of the florist growers have learned that they can pot these in little 4 and 6 inch pots, bring them into bloom. You'll be in Safeway or Trader Trader Joe's and see them blooming there. Those are typically forms of Narcissus caniliculata, sweet scent, but not overwhelming. And then the jonquils, is Narcissa jonquilla, which is an actual species in the genus. And they get maybe 12 inches tall, and they are sweet smelling. They're pungent, but it's generally just the sweet, not the musky. There's parts to the fragrance profile of the genus Narcissus that some people object to, and it's that kind of musky, almost skunky smell that some of them have that many people object to. These don't have that, but you have to search them out. I sell them, but a lot of nurseries don't because they're smaller, but they're very, very, very easy to grow. And by the way, I really know you're from the UK if you walk in and ask me when we'll be getting our jonquils. Jonquil is the generic term for all narcissus and daffodils, apparently used, correct me if I'm wrong out there and you're listening, in the United Kingdom and places like New Zealand and Australia. So if someone asks for jonquils, they just mean daffodils. If someone asks me for daffodils, they usually mean trumpet daffodils. If they ask for narcissus, they usually mean paper whites. All of them are in the genus Narcissus. There is a whole bunch of information about this at redwoodbarn.com because I'm kind of a bulb nerd and I'm really fascinated by them. So you'll find charts that show all the different categories of Narcissus, including the ones that are called daffodils, and a similar chart for tulips if you're into that kind of thing. Just go to redwoodbarn.com, look for the little Google search thing over there in the corner of it, and type bulb, and a whole lot of articles will come up.
If you don't know how to pronounce or spell jonquil, you can always say daffodil.
And they do not need any special soil preparation. They don't need any special fertilizer. There is no need to add anything with phosphorus under the roots as your grandparents told you to do, because that was a standard practice in the past. None of that is really necessary. And they don't, in the case of daffodils or most bulbs, but in particular in the case of daffodils and narcissus, they do not need to be pre-chilled or put in the refrigerator or anything. When you get them, you can plant them. If you can't plant them right away, you can plant them later. You can plant them as late as January with good results. And I've even planted in the spring when I've had leftover bulbs. You generally find them coming into nursery September, October. In my opinion, that's a great time to plant them. But if you don't get around to it right away, there's no urgency. So they are some of the easiest plants to grow. And another thing I will say about them is, since they're mildly toxic, gophers won't eat them. So if you have, whereas tulips, you might as well just put up a salad buffet sign that says gophers over here, because tulips are eaten by, well, not just gophers, squirrels, you name it. Nothing eats daffodils. I've thought about, on my farm, since I have such a problem with gophers, just going around everywhere they surface and sticking daffodil bulbs in wherever they've come up.
Do you think that if you had a stand of tulips, if you planted daffodils in a ring all the way around, do you think that would deter them?
I'm sure someone's tried that. You're listening out there, let us know. because both squirrels and gophers are extremely frustrating with tulips. Cover them with something when you plant them. Wire mesh, the same kind of thing you're using to line holes for gophers. Just cover them over till they push up and out of the ground. And then typically, hopefully, they'll leave them alone. Daffodils, they won't bother. So.
All right, let's look at some of our messages. And Don, if someone wants to send us a message, where do they send it?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
All right. Joan or Joanne, I'm not sure from the spelling which way it's pronounced. I'm going to say Joan. Hi, Don and Lois. I love your show. I'm growing potatoes in a raised metal trough. They seem really healthy and had some white flowers. A week later, those flowers turned to berries. I haven't seen these on potatoes before. What do you know about them?
Yeah, they do. They make little fruit that look like tomatoes. You do need to be aware that they are considered somewhat toxic, so you don't eat them. But yes, potatoes, just like anything else in that family, can make little fruits that make seed. Now, we don't normally grow potatoes from seed, although I know this is confusing because when you go into nurseries to buy your potato starts, which are just potatoes, we call them seed potatoes. That's traditional. That's just a traditional term for the potato root that you're going to cut up and plant to make new potato plants. Having said that, several years ago, a potato variety came on the market called Clancy, and it's seed grown. You can buy the seed on seed racks. It's on our rack at our nursery. It's right there, and you can start them in the winter when you're doing your tomato seedlings, and you can plant them out, and they actually will grow a potato plant and make potatoes, tubers down in the ground that you harvest. So yes, potatoes do set berries, which it's a berry, just like a tomato is technically. And in that berry, there is seed embedded in the flesh. And I suppose you could probably grow that seed if you wanted to, but But if you did that, I can't tell you for sure that you'd get what you're after. Whereas if you buy the seed of Clancy seed-grown potato, you actually will get a predictable outcome. It was an America, all-America selection when it came out because this suddenly enabled people to grow their own potatoes from seed, which can be kind of fun. It's a perfectly good variety. They are a fruit just like the tomato, except that you should be aware that potato foliage and the green parts of potatoes, including the fruit, are considered somewhat toxic.
Well, we have an update from Annie, who wrote to us earlier about her tomato problem.
She writes, I have three early girl tomato plants in my San Rafael garden, Sunset Zone 16. I can rotate them through two raised beds, but not three, as we don't have three raised beds. The raised beds have hardware cloth bottoms, so the roots go through to the hardpan clay soil below. Good. Two of the plants are doing fine, but one of them has weird tomatoes. They are mottled and bumpy. Photos are attached. I'm very curious about what's going on. Are these edible? Are they diseased? Should I have removed them when I first saw their strange coloring? Why do only one of my tomatoes plants have these kinds of tomatoes and the other two don't? I also have a couple of sweet 100s and gold cherry tomatoes.
Okay, so there are two things that are possible causes of the mottling and bumpiness on those. The leaf-footed bug is a big problem here in the Valley, and I assume it's throughout the Bay Area as well. It doesn't usually cause a lot of damage. If you're looking at a nice, perfect red tomato and you see a little sort of yellowish circle in one part of it, that's somewhere that the leaf-footed bug, which is a type of stink bug that has a big flare on its leg, on its foot. So that's where the leaf-footed bug aspect of its name comes from. It pokes its proboscis in. It has a very strong proboscis and causes a very slight sort of irritation to the fruit. And if it's practically fully developed, you just see a slight discoloration. Most people don't even notice it. And yes, it's perfectly fine to eat that. But if several of them get on a young fruit, and we've had several people bring in peaches and tomatoes this year where this happened, on the young fruit, before it expands and they poke in, because they can poke into surprisingly hard fruit, you'll get enough injury that the fruit develops not only bumpy, lumpy look, but also with a mottled appearance. So that possibly is what happened. You just had an early infestation, leaf-footed bug moving in from nearby vegetation or from a nearby tree or a pomegranate, something that they overwintered on. They're very fond of pomegranates. And they cause that damage. And yes, that fruit probably, if you could see the injury early on before the fruit is fully expanded, you might as well just pull that off. It's edible. It's not harmful to you in any way, but it's rather unsightly. I also am aware of a problem here in Yolo County. Don't know if it's common in the Bay Area, ring spot virus, which is transmitted early in the season. I think thrips transmit it or leafhoppers. I'd have to look that up, but it doesn't really matter because you can't control either of those. And again, it makes these circular patterns on the fruit and even some irregularity in the development, but it doesn't hurt the fruit. So commercial growers who are growing tomatoes for the canneries don't care because it makes no difference to them. So they don't go to any effort to control it. And tomatoes are the number one crop in both Yolo and Solano counties. So we have a problem with this here, but I don't think that's a problem in your area. My guess is you're just seeing the injury from stink bugs, particularly the leaf-footed bug, early in the season, early as the fruit was developing. Nothing to worry about. Yes, the fruit's edible. If you see that kind of thing in the future and you've got a bunch of fruit forming, probably just pulling that individual fruit off and tossing it away would be better.
And she had thought maybe she had mosaic, but she writes again and says, I have an update about my tomato problem. I took a tomato from my problematic early girl tomato plant to a farmer, the person I bought it from, at the farmer's market. He told me that I have mosaic disease and recommended that I remove the tomato plant and replace all the soil in my raised beds before planting anything else. I showed a picture of a small non-producing zucchini plant that I had bought from a reputable nursery to another farmer with whom I'm friendly, and he told me I have mosaic disease on it. I looked up mosaic disease on the internet, and Dr. Google told me various ways how to handle it. I understand that it's spread by marauding aphids who infect and run away immediately. Various cures include don't plant anything in that same area for 3 years, water profusely, and mosaic disease will disappear in 3 months or so. Add baking soda, no way, etc. What do I do? My husband does not want to replace the soil. He would rather not have a vegetable garden. Not acceptable to me. Installing a couple of new raised beds is not easily doable because we have too much shade. Please help. You two always provide the best explanations for how to handle gardening problems, and I trust you way more than I trust anyone else. Again,
Okay.
thanks in advance for your wonderful show. Annie from San
Thank you.
Rafael.
Tobacco mosaic virus can be a problem, although I have to tell you, in all my years in business, I don't think I've maybe seen it a few times. It's certainly not a common problem. So I'm a little surprised that just looking at your leaf of your squash and the fruit of your tomato that someone is able to make that diagnosis. It's a fairly extreme set of things that are often recommended for, but bear in mind that not every plant gets TMV. I mean, things that are in the tobacco, tomato, excuse me, the tomato, the solanaceous plants, the nightshade family member, of course, can all get it. Corn doesn't get it. Sunflowers don't get it. There's certainly plenty of, I don't think basil ever gets it. So you could just alternate something else in there. The other thing to remember is that there are tobacco mosaic virus resistant varieties of tomatoes. So if it were me, I would one, plant at least one tomato in a totally different pot. Like go get yourself a barrel or a 15-gallon container. This is next year. And plant one that you really want in that, in nice fresh potting soil, just to be on the safe side. It's keeping the aphids off that really is what most organic farmers and others focus on. It's not the soil residue and all that kind of thing. They want to keep the aphids from coming in and infecting the new crop. So many organic farmers will cover their seedlings and their plants early in the season with floating row cover is the term for the product that's used. It's also the same as what we sell as frost blanket. So you might be wanting to buy it, I don't know, for other reasons soon to protect maybe your bougainvilleas or your young citrus or something in case we get unusually cold. That same material can be put over the bed when the seedlings are in it to prevent the aphids from getting to the new plants. You can leave it there for quite a while. You can leave it there until we get into early summer here in the valley and closer to the coast. You could probably leave it there for the whole summer if you wanted to. Floating row cover is something to look into. Taking out all the residue is just an extreme thing to do without an absolutely firm diagnosis of tobacco mosaic virus. So I personally wouldn't do that. I would look for tobacco mosaic virus, TMV resistant varieties, example being 4th of July, Celebrity. Those are two pretty well-known varieties. Early Girl is not, but it's resistant to other diseases. So you could try a couple of varieties that are not resistant and a couple of varieties that are resistant. I do mention 4th of July and Celebrity because they're both popular and fairly readily obtainable. And just focus on those perhaps next year if you're going to do tomatoes in the same bed. Because you don't have space for anything else. And just in case, I would do a pot with one tomato in it that is separated from that somewhere else where it's sunny, where that's kind of your insurance. So that's probably what I would do. And I would make sure that one's probably a determinate type, simply because in containers, determinate or the more compact varieties are just going to be easier for you to manage. So that's just probably how I would deal with it, because I don't absolutely feel like you really for sure have tobacco mosaic virus, and that's a lot of extreme stuff to do. The one thing you definitely can do in this instance is get all the plant debris out of there. This is a case where I would probably pull the roots out, even though I don't think they're the source of TMV for next year. Might as well. And get all that top stuff out of there and rake all the leaf debris out and all the fruit that's fallen and rotting on the bed. Clean it all out completely. Plant some kind of a cover crop like annual ryegrass, something that's just going to fill the bed with a plant with a cover of green and root in aggressively, and then try again next year. But I wouldn't personally go to the expense and hassle of taking all that soil out without trying these other steps first. So that's what I would do. I would look for TMV resistant varieties. Companies like Seeds and Such, Totally Tomatoes, Burpee will all mention this. There's all kinds of disease resistant varieties on the market now. TMV being one of the things that they have developed varieties that are resistant to. That's what I would focus on. And then see how it goes next year. If you got a real big problem with them, maybe you'll need to replace that soil. But that would be my, I love to sell soil. Okay. I love to sell bags of soil, but that would be a real expense, a lot of work, and I don't think it's absolutely necessary, at least for now.
So, Don, is there a way to, other than looking at one leaf and one, fruit, Is there a way to know whether or not you have this? I mean, like, is there a soil test or is there a
No, you'd have to do leaf tissue analysis. You'd have to have a plant pathologist do it or something. And I just don't know who to refer people to for that kind of thing. You have got a couple of farmers that are looking at samples, and that's reasonable. I look at samples all the time. I wish they would say this is what it might be, not this is what it is, because there's a lot of things that mimic those symptoms. Thrips damage on squash can look very much like virus. All right. And if it happens early in the season, the leaves look like they're infected. And I have heard of other nurseries and hardware stores where they're always diagnosing things as virus. You can't do that. The symptoms are not that clear. Whereas, verticillium wilt, fusarium is really easy to identify. Verticillium wilt is reasonably easy to identify. Nematodes, right now, if you've had a problem with plants wilting during the season, you're pretty sure you were watering them correctly. They didn't do real well, but they still grew, they still fruited, but the fruit was small and so on. Yank that plant up, disregard my usual advice, pull it up and look at the roots, because the symptoms of root knot nematode are very obvious at the end of the season. Of course, you have to pull the plant out to make the diagnosis, so it amounts to an autopsy, but you do it and you look at the roots, they're gnarly. There's, obvious things on them. So that's something you might want to do if you've had a problem, is pull them up and go ahead and take a look at the roots. More of a problem typically out in garden soil than in a container, because you just don't typically have nematodes in container soils, but it is worth looking at least one, especially a plant that didn't do real well. Take a look at the roots. But there are other things that can mimic the symptoms of virus. Squash bug, stink bug, leaf-footed bugs early in the season, repeatedly poking their proboscis into a small fruit right as it goes into the expansion phase, it'll look like it has a virus. Usually you don't get that much damage, but sometimes you do. Yeah, and so I'm concerned that there's a leap to a diagnosis that might lead to unnecessary expense. If you don't mind taking a slight risk of next year having this problem again and doing a little bit of insurance with that one plant in the other pot kind of thing, that's what I would do.
One of the things that she mentioned that she found on the internet, so I'm not sure how well I think about it, was to water profusely and the mosaic disease will disappear in 3 months or so. Are you talking about like flushing it out the
That
bed?
makes no sense whatsoever.
Okay, that's what I wasn't
Okay,
sure.
second.
You never know.
Right. Yeah, right. Second, don't use baking soda in your garden.
Never know.
Okay, for whatever reason, that's the big thing right now. It was Epsom salts for 10 years. You were using them for everything. Now it's suddenly baking soda. Baking soda is a salt. It can burn the leaves, it can burn the foliage. There were some uses for baking soda, some tests of it to prevent certain disease problems in carefully formulated spray solutions to which they would add certain kinds of oil. And in certain circumstances, they found that they could prevent certain diseases in greenhouse production of cucurbits with baking soda sprays. They quickly also found that they could fry the foliage with it, which can happen if you put it on leaves, and it can really damage roots if you put it on the ground. It's a salt. So they quickly moved from baking soda to potassium bicarbonate for certain sprays. And you can actually go to some garden centers and buy potassium bicarbonate-based sprays to prevent mildew on certain plants. This is where this all came from. This is where this whole idea that baking soda is a great thing in the garden. No, please, don't. Okay. And so we really should have a camera on this webcam, on this podcast. My
Oh,
facial
no, you do not want to
expression.
show you. So when you're talking about covering something with the row crop cover,
Cover, row,
row cover,
floating row cover is what it's usually
floating row
called.
cover, you're not really talking about like wrapping it around an individual plant. You're talking about like making a structure where it's an arching over the entire row. Is that what
Yeah,
you're
it's really easy to do if you have a raised planter. I've seen very elegant systems for this. In fact, I posted a long time ago on the Davis Garden Show webpage, and I'll see if I can find that picture and put it up again, of how one couple dealt with the white crown sparrow problem.
Yeah, I remember that.
They took half inch PVC, the thin wall stuff. You don't need anything fancy for this. They attached it on one side, looped it over to the other side, so you had this row of of arches going
Arches.
over it, and they just put the floating row cover over the top. It kept the white crowned sparrows off. It did a really good job. They wouldn't go in there. It didn't, it didn't keep the squirrels or tree rats out, but at least it kept the birds out. And they just attached it to the planter with clothespins. And so they didn't even have to nail it or staple it or anything. So they were able, their able to reuse that floating row cover for several years. If you staple it on, it's going to tear, so you'll probably have to replace it within a year or two. But it's a really simple way to get a little extra heat late in the season. Maybe you're trying to keep those pepper plants going until the fruit ripens in late November, December. You can do that. It's a way to keep white ground sparrows off of young pea seedlings and lettuce and things like that. And it can reduce these flying pests. The aphid cycle is that the winged mama flies in and lands. She then starts popping out as many as 50 babies a day, all of which, by the way, are clones of her and are all pregnant. So that's where the sheer numbers come from. But it starts with her landing under certain temperature conditions, certain day length conditions when they show up. And so if you can keep them off of there, and that goes for leaf hoppers and white flies and some of the other vectors for these different diseases, if you can just keep the vector off the plant, then you can avoid the problem that way. So maybe covering it over, that might make it possible for you to get an earlier start to your season. You can plant a little earlier because you've made this kind of mini greenhouse out there with the added benefit of some pest protection.
And when Don is describing that and you out there are trying to figure out what the heck's he saying, imagine those hoops that are going of the arches that are going along the thing. They don't come off. They just stay there. If you take the cloth off, you can still reach in and, you know, it doesn't get in the way at all. And then when you need the cloth again, you just flop it over.
You can plant green beans on them. You can use them for all kinds of purposes. And by the way, when they do this commercially, those are called hoop houses. Hoop houses. It's a type of greenhouse. They talk about hoop house production of melons and cucurbits and things like that. They just stick them in the ground and arch them over and make a really simple primitive greenhouse that way.
Hey, Don, how did your tomatoes do? Can you give us a quick summary? I know you're not quite finished, but how did they do?
Oh, yeah, there's six that have really, really taken off and done well, leading the pack. Bodacious, we've mentioned that one before, outstanding performer. Chef's Choice Orange, many, many fruit on it. Lemon Boy, this year's big star performer, dozens of fruit, bright yellow. New Girl, outperforming Early Girl for the third year in a row. Principa Borghese, which is a little compact guy that has amazing rich fruit for drying and sauces. And our old friend Rugby, star performer again. So those are the six top performers of the 35 varieties I grew this year. We'll give them another update towards the end of the season because a whole lot of them set great during the cooler weather in August. So we should be able to, some of them are going to perhaps pull up into that ranking as the season goes along.
Hey, Don, I just saw my first Junco yesterday. This is so exciting. Oh. It means that the little ground birds are coming back. You're going to have white crowned sparrows in a couple of weeks.
Oh, good.
So we are now closing our show with a saying, and today it is, gardening isn't just a hobby, it's a way of life.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
We've got some new programming here at KDRT. Check out Grist for the Chill, live Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m., where Dave serves up a truly interesting mix of music with a focus on fingerstyle guitar and percussive groove as it relates to roots, world fusion, jazz, funk, Latin, and Brazilian music, and more. That's Thursdays, 10 to 11 a.m., Grist for the Chill.